I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Little bit of a different introduction for this special fundraiser edition of Parallax Views. You're hearing the track No Time by Liam Thomas. I thought the title was apropos. Let's cut to the chase. This is a fundraiser for a family in Pittsburgh who are currently experiencing some troubles related to healthcare. Their father was in a freak accident earlier this year that led to a fractured C7 and paralysis from the chest down. His Medicare days have unfortunately run out, but he still needs 24/7 care and is currently in rehab. On this episode, we'll be interviewing a number of guests about the healthcare crisis in America, the need for health justice, issues and debates around Medicare for All, and more. Please, if you can, consider donating to the GoFundMe page linked to in the description. Any amount will help, and it is much appreciated. I hope this episode will leave you moved enough to donate. And now, the first guest on this edition of Parallax Views, this fundraiser special, Ben Burgess, author of the Zero Books title, Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left, on the arguments that can get us towards better healthcare in America. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Ben Burgess, author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left, available now from Zero Books.
All right, glad, great to be back on.
Well, Ben, I wanted to have you on because I'm doing a fundraiser for a family here in my hometown of Pittsburgh who are having issues with healthcare. Their father had a very bad accident recently, and they're unable to afford to pay for things. So they've started a GoFundMe, and I think it really shows how important healthcare reform is right now. Maybe we could start with, what is your basic view on healthcare and where it needs to go? I take it you're not one of the people who thinks that ACA, or what some people call Obamacare, is that's just enough as it is. We should keep it as it is. You're not one of the people that thinks we should keep that and not go further, right?
I'm definitely not. I've actually just started a new full-time job today, actually. But before that, my wife and I were both adjuncts at Rutgers for the last few years, which means that we actually did have to get healthcare on the ACA exchanges. And we can get into that a little bit more if you'd like. But the short version is it was not a fun experience. I think that it's overwhelmingly clear that the idea that you could do this Rube Goldberg contraption of, you know, different regulatory patches for all 500 things that are wrong with private health insurance, was just, you know, the whole thing. I know I'm mixing metaphors like crazy here, but, was just a complete dead end. It's a disaster. It's not that it didn't help anybody. Of course it did. You know, it is better than what came before, but it failed certainly in the main kind of test for any important reform, which is that it has that kind of popular support that makes it hard to take it away, which is pretty obvious because the Republicans were able to symbolically vote to repeal it like hundreds of times. If they'd done that once with Medicare, they never would have won another election. So the ACA is not getting it done. We need at the very least to nationalize health insurance. That would get us to the Canadian system, if not actually going, you know, which is probably the best we're going to get, you know, anytime soon. So I support that. Ideally, the best thing would be to go further and get an NHS like Britain.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me. I was just reading a poll that I think The Hill in D.C. reported on, and they're a very reputable news outlet. And they released last year that there was a poll saying that 70% of Americans support Medicare for all. And yet we're told that, you know, oh, no one supports Medicare for all. Yet The Hill is reporting last year that there's 70% support for it.
Yes. It's remarkable. And the thing is, I think it's actually always polled reasonably well, but especially in the last few years since Bernie ran the first time, which one of the real lasting effects of that campaign is that it's actually on the table now in American politics. People take it seriously as a possibility. And yeah, people get very excited about it, as they should be, because they know they shouldn't have to pay for emergency medical expenses with GoFundMe. That's absurd that, you know, that there shouldn't be people who – there shouldn't be diabetics who literally die because they can't afford their insulin, which – I mean, there are depressing stories about that much more regularly than there should be. Just read one recently about a diabetic guy who switched to different form of insulin because he was in he wanted to free up money for the wedding and it didn't work as well. That's totally absurd. I mean, everybody, like, the talking point that we've got right now during the 2020 primaries is, well, okay, you know, sure, I'd say, as a reasonable centrist Democrat, you know, Medicare for all, that sounds nice, but, you know, why not just Medicare for all who want it? You know, why, like, rip people away from the loving arms of their insurance companies, which is one of these things that I hope it doesn't that doesn't really land, because I think most – and I'm cautiously optimistic that it will not, because most people know that no sane person loves their insurance company. That's not a phenomenon that exists.
Well, you know, I guess a lot of people like to argue that a Medicare for all plan would, you know, it would limit our freedoms. But I know that you've argued on the Michael Brooks show, which we here at Parallax Views are big fans of, that actually, you know, Medicare for all could be very emancipatory. It could be liberating for people.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, there is a extremely narrow sense in which it does limit your freedom, that you have you no longer have this choice that some people have. Most people don't have, by the way, under the current system, to choose between health insurance providers. Most people who have private health insurance just have whatever their boss picked for them anyway, so it's a non-issue. Some people who are lucky enough that they don't have employer health insurance, they have to buy health insurance on the exchange, which actually most people who are in that situation do not consider themselves lucky for that. As bad as employer insurance is, it's better than having to buy it on the exchange. So that means that you get to choose between Aetna and Blue Cross, and I guess that's a choice. But I think it's safe to say that that's not a kind of choice. That's not a kind of autonomy that means very much to most people. If you think about the great free, you know, like, you know, the big freedoms, you know, the freedoms that are in the Bill of Rights or FDR's four freedoms, freedoms of the UN Charter. That's generally not one that's included, right? You know, that's not something that's not really up there with, you know, freedom of religion and, you know, freedom of speech, that, you know, that you have the freedom to decide between Aetna and Blue Cross Blue Shield. It's not really a difference that that matters very much to most people. To the extent that it does matter, it's because they want to make sure that they can see the doctor that they need to see, and they're worried that that doctor or the medication they need will be priced out, or the doctor they like will be out of plan. But of course, if that's what you're concerned about, then you have much more choice under Medicare for All, because the only way to go out of plan is to leave the country. That, you know, every doctor is now in plan. And so you actually have considerably more choice there. And more importantly, it's liberatory in a much deeper sense, which is that right now health insurance is one of the strings that keeps people attached to their current jobs. That that, you know, it's always in the back of your mind if you consider any scenario where you got fired or you quit, that, oh crap, that means that we'd lose our current health insurance, which would mean that maybe you know, couldn't see the doctor that I'm seeing anymore, which would mean that I'm worried that, you know, about the particular medications. And even if it's a temporary disruption, well, okay, so this is something that in the last few years, my wife and I have gone through a few times, and as, you know, comparatively privileged people, right? You know, like, get to, like, you know, I mean, I get to stand in front of roomfuls of 19-year-olds talking about philosophy for a living, right? That's, like, vastly better than most jobs under capitalism. But even under those circumstances, right, you know, this is bullshit that that we've had to deal with many times because of my wife's prescription medication, which she's been taking the same stuff for years and years and years and years. But every time that health insurance switches, then it's this race against the clock to find a new psychiatrist who's in plan, who's who can write that prescription. But of course, you have to first have that first meeting before the meeting where he writes the prescription. At that point, you're a new patient, so it takes forever to schedule it. You have to wait forever. Then you have to wait for that second time when he actually writes the prescription. And all the while, you're counting out those pills, which is an insane level of stress to have, just as a matter of course, even for people who don't, you know, I'm describing a situation where there are no long-term disruptions even. And this is a process everybody hates. It's stressful. It's depending on the kind of medication we're talking about, it's incredibly, it can be very dangerous. So this is always going to be in the back of your mind in all kinds of situations, because say, hey, you know, if I don't do exactly what my boss says, then I might get fired. You know, if I
get a tattoo.
Yeah. If I get, like, anything from I get a tattoo to I'm on TV participating in a political protest, to I, you know, over, you know, I say things on Facebook that my employer might not like, to certainly organize in a union. You're not legally supposed to get fired for that, but people do all the time. Any of those things, right? That's always got to be in the back of your mind. Uh-oh, what about the health insurance? It's going to disrupt the health insurance. Even if I get a new job right away, that just starts the clock for that process that I just described. And so that's a pretty powerful incentive for people to keep their heads down and do what the boss wants them to do in terms both at work and outside of work. And so, yeah, cutting that string is absolutely an emancipatory thing. And that's a much deeper kind of freedom, a kind of freedom that humans have much more reason to care about than this kind of freedom that you have trying to, you know, window shop on the exchange and decide whether, you know, Aetna or Blue Cross is screwing you over a little bit more.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, I've seen Joe Biden in some of his campaign videos. He's talking to people who say, oh, I like my private insurance. Don't get rid of it. That's why I support you, Joe Biden. and, you know, I'm one of these people. I think at best, even if we can get a better public option, I think we can make the private option obsolete, essentially, because I think the public option can do better. I'm one of these people that actually has some faith in a public infrastructure. Yeah. But maybe you could comment on this whole idea of I'm going to lose my private insurance.
Yeah. So there are a couple things that should be said about that. So the first is that there are some benefits of Medicare for All or anything really on the spectrum from Canadian style Medicare for all up through the British system where the hospitals are publicly owned, that any system where you have like that has certain built-in structural advantages that you don't get if you just have a public option. So one example of what I'm talking about is if the government is the single payer, then that gives a tremendous amount of bargaining power for setting prices throughout the system. So this is something, in fact, is often a anti-Medicare for All talking point. People say, oh, Medicare for All won't really solve all the problems with U.S. healthcare because we have so much costs with the drug companies, with the hospitals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, it shouldn't take that much insight about economics to see that if you have one payer, right, then they have a tremendous bargaining edge over the multiplicity of sellers in that system. And if you've just got a public option and some private options, then you've thrown that away. So that's one problem. Another problem with just having a public option and private options, to lean on personal experience again, you know, there's a point a few years ago when we just gotten back from the postdoc that I did in Korea, and I was I hadn't gotten a new job yet. I was starting to substitute teach, but that hadn't really, you know, very much that hadn't come through yet. When for a minute my wife and I were on Medicaid in Michigan, which was great, right? Like that's in most ways that's the best, you know, that's the best health insurance I've ever been on, at least in this country.
Can I add something real quick?
Yeah.
I didn't let you know when we started the episode, but actually the person whom this fundraiser is for, George Wessel out here in Pittsburgh, he's actually a ninth grade algebra teacher. So you know, you guys have a lot in common, and I think you would like talking logic with him.
Nice.
But go on.
So Medicaid in most ways is great, but the one big problem with Medicaid is that there are lots of doctors who won't take it because they have a policy that, you know, that they don't take Medicaid patients because they get better payouts from the private companies. And so that's a problem, again, you can solve if you have a public monopoly on health insurance. If it's the only game in town, if it's the single payer, then everybody has to take it, you know, or you go out of business. And finally, if you just have a public option, well, the question is, who's it going to be an option for, right? So is it going to be an option for everybody, right? Anybody who just wants to can signify that they want it. Do you still have to pay some sort of premium for it? If so, you're going to get a lot of people still falling through the cracks. You're going to get a lot of people, if it's not available to everybody, you get a lot of people stuck in the employer system. They're subject to all the problems that we've been talking about. But, like, I think the last thing that should be maybe said about this issue about, like, okay, why not just Medicare for all who want it, is that if you're saying, oh, I like my private health insurance, right? These people, you know, who are saying this to Joe Biden and, you know, whatever, I'm sure that there are actual people who are saying that to him. Some of that's because people are very confused, and he's deliberately and maliciously adding to the confusion. He's also been very cynical about it, by the way, because he's often talking about people who have these like really good, like top of the line union healthcare plans, which in fact his and Barack Obama's baby, the ACA, originally had a provision in it called the Cadillac tax that was specifically designed to discourage those plans on the theory that people were overusing, you know, doctors and hospitals because they didn't have to pay anything when they were on those plans. that got relatively recently taken out of it, but that was in the ACA originally, and it never kicked in because the most unpopular provisions, they waited for years and years for them to kick in, and it got taken out before that. But again, that just shows this hypocrisy on this issue. But sure, let's say some of these people are really saying this. Well, most of them are just confused because they don't understand that if we had Medicare for all, you know, what they care about, they could still get. They could still see the doctor that they like, right? They, you know, nobody would stop them from seeing that doctor, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes the most sophisticated version of this argument, people will say, oh, no, but it's not going to be the same. Because you have waiting times. You have waiting, you know, you like the wait times are increased in socialized systems. So, and if somebody really knows their stuff, they might point to the alleged doctor shortage in Canada to back this up. And the thing now, there's the actual number of doctors per capita in Canada and the United States is not really that different. And if you want to solve this, and really to the extent that there is a problem in Canada, it's that when people come out of med school, they go into the specialized fields instead of becoming GPs because the pay is better, right? And that helps them pay back their loans. So if you really want to solve this problem, you could do it the way that Cuba successfully did, which is covering people's college and medical school, med school for free, right? Like Cuba is a tiny impoverished country, but they have a way better doctor per patient ratio than either Canada or the United States. But ultimately, though, if what people are saying when they say this, oh, there's going to be greater wait times. Okay, maybe. Like I said, I think that's a solvable problem. I think it's a problem that's solvable with more social democracy, not less. But it's also – there's a sense in which this is just a really morally depraved view that you're saying, okay, I don't want there to be a universal system that would cover everybody because of the greater wait times. What you're essentially saying when you know, down to brass tacks is I'm okay with some people dying who would live otherwise, right? There's no doubt that more people – that the rate of what stats guys call mortality amenable to healthcare. In other words, people dying who wouldn't have died if medical professionals had intervened in time, that rate is way higher in the U.S. than in countries with socialized systems. So what you're saying is I'm okay with more people dying who wouldn't have died for the sake of me still being able to buy my way to the head of the line. And I'm just fundamentally unwilling to make that trade-off, right? Like I think that if we – you know, that there are ways of expanding the number of doctors, but if we're concerned that there are limited resources – then I think the idea that, well, the solution to that is for some people just not to have access to those resources while other people, because they have better jobs, that, you know, provide insurance, et cetera, are able to just buy their way to the head of the line is something that, like, when you kind of get down to what people are really saying when they say that, I think the only possible response is just kind of disgusted silence.
Yeah, well, I was going to add to that. I mean, even the fact that someone has to start, a family has to start a Kickstarter or a GoFundMe in this case, just to get their father proper medical help, you know.
Right, but as long as your upper middle class self doesn't have to wait. Yeah, right, that's the trade-off, right? That family has to start the GoFundMe. And most medical and by the way, I mean, I hope in this case everything works out. Seems like, you know, there's a lot that's being done to help it out. So, you know, here's hoping. But, you know, most medical GoFundMes are not paid out.
Well, you know, I just wanted to ask you one more thing. You know, in regards to the public versus private debate, I guess people also point towards the NHS. And people say, oh, the NHS isn't working well right now. And it's like my understanding of problems with the NHS is that we've been, you know, in Britain, it's been completely, there's been a wrecking ball hitting it for years now. The sort of neoliberals have been attacking it and deconstructing it. And then when it doesn't work, they'll say, see, publicly owned hospitals don't work. The NHS doesn't work. When really they're creating the conditions for that in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, so Zero Books has a article about that, has a book about that by Yusuf El Gingi. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, called How to Dismantle the NHS in 10 Easy Steps. That's precisely about this vicious cycle that you're talking about, where Tory governments underfund the NHS. The underfunding causes shortages and problems that in turn, you know, that in turn people could point to and say, oh my God, look at how terrible the NHS is. And that's absolutely true. But also two other points about this. One is that even now, right, the NHS is not what it used to be. It's been under attack really since the Thatcher years in the 80s. There have been all kinds of cuts, slow motion privatization, you know, two-tier hospitals. All of this stuff has happened, right? So it's not as good as it used to be, no doubt about that. But even after all of that, British people, and, you know, by the way, you know, my sister has lived in the UK for decades. I've been over, you know, been over there lots of times. You know, none of this is because of like better diet or lifestyle or anything like that, right? You know, that's not a factor. So British people still live longer than Americans. Life expectancy is higher. Infant mortality is lower. Mortality amenable to healthcare is lower. So even in the damaged form that it exists right now, and I really hope the absolute boy comes in there and fixes it up. But even in the damaged form where it exists right now, the NHS still performs way better than America's private system. And the thing I find most interesting about this, that I think is the biggest tell about all this, when people, you know, American conservatives or sometimes even neoliberal Democrats will say, oh, you know, these socialized systems, they're so terrible, you know, the wait times, the shortages, this, that, you know, and they'll tell some horror story about they've heard about Canada or some horror story they've heard about the UK. And a lot of times, if you look into the details of these stories, obviously these things are super misleading. But all that's kind of noise. I think when you strip it down to the basic thing, like really what you got to look at is, okay, so where are all the Canadians like demanding to switch over to the American system, right? Where are the crowds of British people waving around placards saying abolish the NHS? They don't exist.
Well, amen to that. Maybe on a closing note, you can give my listeners an idea about what we can do to achieve what Tim Faust is calling a health justice now, and also plug your work, your book, any projects you have coming up in the near future.
Sure. So one thing that you can certainly do is, you know, I am a big Menshevik electoralist. I think that I think elections matter a lot. And so, you know, you can certainly organize for Bernie Sanders for president, who's the person who is most out of the field. Let's put it this way. He's the most unambiguous advocate of Medicare for all. There are a couple who are a little ambiguous about it, but he's the one who's like really unambiguously in favor of it. And even more importantly, on some level, if you have, you know, state and local primaries where there's a candidate who really wants to run on Medicare for all, you should support them. DSA certainly does all kinds of canvassing to support Medicare for all. So did National Nurses United also does a whole lot for this effort. So if you have any contact with either of those two organizations, hook up with them to see what you can do, you know, and it's going to be like, in some ways it's depressing because it sounds like such a, you know, if you kind of take a step back, it seems like such a small thing, right? All we're asking for here is what they've already had in Canada for decades. But it's going to be a huge fight, right? There's no way to get this done without that being a huge fight, and all those all those things that I mentioned, and I'm sure lots of other things that you know about that you could mention would massively help with that. And then switching from, switching from the crusade for the desperately needed reform that'll save a bunch of people's lives to crass self-promotion. So I've got a book which was mentioned at the top of the interview, Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. You can get from all the usual places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. If you want to support your local bookstore instead of getting it from Amazon and Barnes & Noble, they probably don't stock it, but you could probably get them to order you a copy. I've also got a weekly segment on the Michael Brooks Show called The Debunk, where we usually take apart arguments like some of the anti-Medicare for All arguments we've been talking about on this segment. And most recently, I've also got a weekly column in Jacobin, and it's been nothing about Medicare for All on there yet, but the first two were about the minimum wage and the Green New Deal, and those seem to have been coming out on weekends.
Well, I want to give a shout out myself to the Michael Brooks Show and the Majority Report. I know someone involved with both operations actually posted about this GoFundMe campaign in the Discord there. So shout out to the Majority Report and Michael Brooks' crew. We're currently at almost 5K of the 40K goal.
Nice.
As I record this. So I want to thank you, though, Ben, for coming on and helping us support this cause. It really means a lot to me.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. And, in different capacities, different parts of her life, but math teacher is also my, my mother's profession, broadly speaking, math education. So that's pulling for the guy, and anything else I can do, to help promote this, just let me know.
Next up on this Parallax Views fundraising special, an impassioned conversation with friend of the show, Chuck O'Chelly of the O'Chelly Effect radio program and network. Chuck has some thoughts on the healthcare situation in America, and he does not hold back. It's a rather emotional perspective on the issue of health justice and the crisis of healthcare in America. And now, without further ado, my conversation with Chuck O'Chelly. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Chuck O'Chelly of the O'Chelly Effect.
Yeah, that's me. Is that the whole of the intro?
Well, we're trying to move it along quick for this episode, since we have a bunch of short segments we're doing.
Fair enough. This is a special episode, right? And facts are facts and realities are realities. What it comes down to is there's an unfortunate circumstance in this country, which is not just unfortunate. Actually, that sounds apologetic. Let me take that back. It's not unfortunate. It's actually revolting. It's actually horrendous. It's actually cruelty based on financial situations. Look, bottom line is, regardless of the details of this particular story, there are a lot of people who basically get told on a daily basis, look, you don't have the money to live. Well, I guess your life is no longer worth preserving. And this is a circumstance I've faced personally. Obviously, I haven't lost my life yet for lack of care, but believe me, I've suffered for it. And I've also had, people that I've lost based on that. It's a hard thing to get into, but the reality is this: there is absolutely no cause for that to be the situation. this is a revolting situation where whether it's insurance companies or it's the Medicare or Medicaid limiting exactly what is viable as far as taking care of a human life, I do not understand how it is that we're in this circumstance today. I do not. I mean, I know why. I know why. It's not that I don't know why. It's not that I don't know the particulars. It's not that I don't know what the financial pressures are. It's not that I don't know what the cost-benefit analysis is. What I don't understand is how this is allowed to continue and how it is that we haven't, you know, through sheer sanity, come to some level of universal health care in this country, which is what? One of the only industrialized, civilized, right? First world nations that doesn't actually have it. And we shouldn't have to do a special for this man. We should not have to do a special for anybody.
We shouldn't even have to do GoFundMes just to raise money for someone who is in need in our community. You should not have to do that. It's ridiculous.
No, look, you know, and that's the thing. I have had to raise money when I've had abscessed teeth. Okay, I'm sitting here with an infection in my skull that, you know, believe it or not, that is a life-threatening situation if it gets far enough. And believe me, it's gone far before. And I've had to raise money personally in order to take care of those needs because not eligible for this, not eligible for that, you know, can't get into the Obamacare because I can't afford it. Whole bunch of different things. Okay, that's the truth. This is not a tolerable situation. And, you know, the idea that somebody's parent, that somebody's brother, that somebody's sister, that somebody's mother, that somebody's anybody has to sit there and face the reality that you just might not have enough in your bank account to be worthy of saving when it comes to your life. It is beyond reprehensible. It is beyond greed. It is one of the most soulless aspects of the system in which we live right now. And it doesn't matter because, you know, there is government health care for this and that, but it only goes so far. And then there's, well, maybe you can go get assistance. Well, maybe you can't, actually. Not everybody's eligible for that, in case people are not aware. Not everybody's eligible for, you know, all of the assistance programs that they imagine are out there, or that they've heard about, or that are legend, where everything gets taken care of. It doesn't. And what it comes down to, quite honestly, is that if we don't take care of each other currently, and if we don't change the circumstance soon, you know, there's going to be a lot more deaths that you're not going to know about. There's going to be a lot more people who don't get to finish raising their kids. There's going to be a lot more people who don't get to finish living their lives simply because they didn't have enough in the bank. And that, my friends, is bullshit. Bottom line. So I felt like I needed to say that, JJ. I felt like that is absolutely necessary. It's one of these things that, you know what, call me a liberal, call me a communist, call me a socialist. I don't give a shit. This is not humane. This is not the way, you know, humanity could behave. And it's absolutely ridiculous that this is one of those things that is just out there for purchase. And that's it. You don't have the money, your life is not worth preserving.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that keeps coming up in the interviews I've done for this episode so far is, you know, there's always this argument of, well, if we had an NHS system like in Britain, or if it was more like Canadian healthcare, oh, you may have to wait longer. Which to me is basically saying, well, I have my money and I should get in first. And these people, if they can't get in because they don't have the money, fuck them. That's sort of the mentality. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I'll tell you something else too. Let me dispel one of those things right there. JJ, you talk to people across the planet, don't you?
Yes, indeed.
You know what? I talk to people in the UK, okay, where obviously, you know, I don't quite understand all of the way those people live over there. I talk to people in Canada. I got to be honest with you. When I describe to them the particulars – of how things work for somebody like me who has no health insurance, when I describe to them what it costs for me to go and do things like get a tooth pulled or buy some antibiotics or whatever else, they think I'm talking crazy. They say that can't be possible. We don't have these problems there. And I say to them exactly what you just mentioned, which is what most people say. Well, gee, if we had the National Healthcare Service, then you'd have to wait and you'd be on lines and you're on death panels. You know what? None of these people report this stuff to me, and these are common people. Nobody's rich that I know. Nobody is in a position to do anything other than accept the bare minimum, and they don't suffer like this. They do not suffer like this, and they don't lose everything because they're sick, and they don't lose everything because they're injured. And they don't, you know, you break a bone in your neck or your back, and by the way, I've done both, and you're finished. Your life is over. They drain you of whatever it is you have, and then when it's all gone, so are you, because you can't afford to keep going. No, that's not what happens in these other places. They don't wait all that long either, by the way. That's another fallacy, the idea that, oh, it's not the best health care. Really, it sounds pretty good to me, and a lot of people do a lot better spending next to nothing or nothing. Okay, in many other industrialized nations, and they think I am absolutely insane when I'm trying to raise money for my teeth, and they're going, why do you need $500 to, irrigate an infection and pull a tooth? And because that's what it costs, baby. And they say, you got to be kidding me. How can it cost them? It does. And the absolute piracy with which you're treated by the medical industrial complex, okay, that does nothing but punish those who don't have deep pockets, it's just absolutely criminal and really, like I said, soulless beyond belief. So I'm going to tell you what, any which way that you can, when you see somebody who's in this kind of need, until we can find a way to change this circumstance, especially this guy that we're talking about today. But even so, anybody you see that's suffering like this, if you got a way to alleviate that, how can you not?
Well, I was going to add too, you know, this is the person we're raising funds for is a ninth grade algebra teacher. He has given back to his community constantly. And to see, you know, him being told, well, your Medicare days have run out, even though he still needs 24/7 inpatient care, they're basically telling him to screw off in a lot of ways. And to me, just the fact that he has given so much to his community alone annoys me. I mean, I think everyone should be getting good health care regardless of their standing in the community. But it's just beyond me how we've gotten to this point.
Well, you know, and that's the funny thing is that in some places, you know, you end up in county jail, you can get a little more health care. And if you absolutely give yourself over to something, sometimes you can get a little more health care. But it all runs out because it's all about a for-profit industry. And this is the thing, you know, and like you said, regardless of who this guy is in the community, you know, is this not a man? Is this not a human being? All right. Well, that's all you got to tell me. I don't see how anybody is more valuable than anybody else. I mean, yes, indeed, there are people who sort of, you know, already punched their card as far as being part of humanity, and maybe they don't deserve your help. There are people like that because they're just terrible people. But this is not the majority of the people that are going to die from lack of funds. This is not the majority of people who are going to lose everything they ever earned, had, or thought they had because something went wrong. And that's what the problem is. So, no, absolutely. Even better that he was somebody who contributed to the community. But you know what? It doesn't matter. You're talking about a man. You're talking about a living, breathing person who was not, you know, again, not one of these people who I think gave away their eligibility to be here any longer. You know, even if you believe that some people just deserve to die, let me tell you something. The majority of the people that are going to die because they do not have the funds, they do not have the resource, they do not have the access, which is a BS term, by the way, that they throw out there, access. yeah, I got access to billions of dollars, quite honestly, but not like I'm going to realistically lay my hands on them. And you know what? When you're damaged because of an injury, or you are hindered or hobbled because of an illness, this is exactly the time that that people need to take care of each other. This is not the time to start deciding who's worthy of anything or who's not. And quite frankly, you know, again, I'm doing this, talking to you right now, in between a lot of other things. I could be doing other things, but this needs to be understood that especially a guy like this, whose story I'm sure you've told, you know, quite a bit better than I possibly could, even though I've read and looked at the circumstance here. It's not even relevant to me. The fact that we're talking about a man who was injured, a man who was obviously out there earning his way. And look, things go wrong. It's just that simple. And people don't just deserve to be left for dead. Not in a society that they keep telling us has so much opportunity, has so much greatness. You know, where is American exceptionalism when it comes to being humane to one another, especially when somebody has actually found themselves in a circumstance that they didn't expect to be in? You know, I mean, what else can you say, JG?
Well, I just wanted to ask you two more things real quick. I wanted to get your take. The first is, to me, you know, I think a lot of this just goes beyond politics. Whether you know, you can talk about liberalism and socialism and conservatism, but we should care about the people in our community. And, you know, it's beyond politics for me in a lot of ways.
No, absolutely. But that's the thing. I'm not talking about politics. I'm talking about there are resources available. There is the possibility here. And if it's not on a cost benefit, I mean, this is business. Is business politics? Maybe. But, you know, because we have a healthcare business here, all right, that is not, you know, absolutely part of the package when you're just here. I mean, you could literally probably fly this guy to another country where they would take care of him better, just as a guest, you know, than he's going to get here. And cheaper, by the way. You know, that's the scary thing about this, is that I've actually known people who have gone to other countries in order to get medical care because their trip, their hotel, their medical care altogether, even what they charge a foreigner in a lot of other places, it's still way less than what they would have paid here. And here they would have been broken. And that's the thing. You either get broken or you get gone. And, you know, is that the place you want to be in? That's not where I want to be in. And again, I think it's way beyond politics. It's about, you know, compassion. It's about decency. It's about empathy. It's about how about imagine yourself in that position. So, yeah, you're right. It's way beyond politics.
Well, amen to that, Chuck. Is there any more, you know, maybe personal anecdotes you can share about the healthcare system? I know not just you, but also people you've known. You've seen a lot of shit, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, see, I got to be honest with you, man. I was always disturbed by this, but of course, it never fully disturbed me until. Well, you know, it really reached right into the middle of my world, right? So the truth is that, look, I got married twice. And the first wife, you know, I was happy to get rid of her. It was a divorce. It was all right. you know, cost me everything, but believe me, I would have paid double the price. Now, my second wife was a different story. And in 2012, the fact is that I just didn't have the resources. And that's really what it came down to. And I can't even relate to you exactly what that did, but it just it forever burned in me the idea that some people, according to the system, according to other people's, you know, interesting points of view, and according to a lot of people's politics, that that some people just are not worthy of living because they don't have the money. And that is unacceptable, man. That is just absolutely unacceptable. And trying to live with that afterwards, yeah, not easy. Not easy.
Well, hey, Chuck, I want to thank you a lot for opening up in this short segment for the fundraiser. If there's anything else you have to say or want to get out there, or even if you want to tell listeners how they can listen to the Acelli Effect, go ahead and do that right now. And thank you so much once again.
Well, look, I you know, when it comes to what you're doing right now, I don't care about promoting the show. It's this is just, you know what, here's my voice added to the chorus, and hopefully other people are saying very similar things to what I'm saying. And if not, and if you're not thinking very similar things to what I'm saying, I wonder why. You know, personally, I say that to you, the listener. I say to you that, you know what, if you've got something that you can contribute toward, you know, somebody else not having to die for lack of funds, for God's sake, you know, for fuck's sake, you know, help out. That's all I can say, man.
Thank you again, Chuck, for coming on Parallax Views and helping out with this fundraiser effort.
You're welcome.
And now a conversation with Patrick Farnsworth of the Last Born in the Wilderness podcast. Patrick mainly focuses on environmental issues, and in this discussion, we tie together health justice with environmental justice. The battle we are fighting to build better communities brings together activists from all corners. And now, on to my conversation with Patrick Farnsworth of the Last Born in the Wilderness podcast. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Patrick Farnsworth of the Last Born in the Wilderness podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man. It's good to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Patrick, I'm doing a bunch of, you know, little short segments with different guests in support of a GoFundMe fundraiser for a family in Pittsburgh whose father, after a freak accident, had a C7 fracture. He's paralyzed from the chest down, and you know, it sort of just gets me mad that, you know, they have to start a GoFundMe because his Medicare ran out in regards to inpatient, and he needs the inpatient care right now. He really can't be alone. He needs sort of intensive therapy for this stuff, intensive care, and you know, it boggles my mind that we live in a country where you have to start a GoFundMe just to get care.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I've seen this phenomenon too. I mean, it's over the years since this idea of starting an online fundraiser, more and more of it seems to be geared towards just struggling families or individuals that, you know, they, just like so many Americans, I think that many people are listening can resonate with that or kind of see reflections of themselves in. So many families across the United States in particular are just unable to pay for basic healthcare needs, whether it's an emergency situation like you mentioned with this fundraiser we're doing this for, or if it's just preventative care, you know, very like minimal doctor checkups and making sure you have the right medicine and dealing with it ahead of time, you know, preventative care. Most Americans just don't have access to that. And so this phenomenon I've been seeing of GoFundMes, which are, of course, I mean, people will do what they have to do to get the funds required. But I think particularly other people in other countries, just even north, if you go to Canada or you go to other places that have even just marginally better healthcare systems, they're kind of, I think they're sort of appalled by it. They see this desperation and they don't know what to make of it. So it's interesting to see this trend, and it's actually rather disturbing and frightening. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, have you had any personal experiences with the healthcare system, or have you known anyone that have had experiences with it that were a bit rocky?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been really lucky. I mean, I haven't had any major, you know, health issues for myself. And I've been able to avoid some of the worst, the more disturbing, you know, aspects of the healthcare system. But, you know, as we were talking about before we started this interview, I mentioned a couple people that I knew, I know that I'm close to that. For instance, I have a friend who is 21, I think. He just, maybe 22. He was diagnosed with testicular cancer this year, I believe. And, similar situation with maybe not, I think there was an online donation thing set up, but also there was just community efforts to get enough money to his family so they could afford just even the first, phase of treatment, to get a surgery and do all the things he required. And I mean, he's definitely recovered or is recovering from this, but seeing it's just him talking to me. I remember just seeing like a person that was generally very in generally good spirits, just sort of being crushed by the reality of the system. Cause it was the first time he personally had to, just look at it and see what was required for him to even get the most basic care, and not having that insurance and not having that, you know, it was really hard to see my friend go through that experience. And of course it was also, I mean, it's inspiring to see people come together and work together to help him out and raise that money that they needed. But the thing is like we were saying, this phenomenon of seeing all these GoFundMes and fundraisers. I mean, I've seen so many people just asking for just pennies just so that they can help reach their goal. And it's like, how do we kind of get to the root of this problem, which is that we shouldn't have these GoFundMes. We should have actual substantial, robust healthcare system that takes care of people. And like I mentioned with preventative care, you know, if people had a sense that they could go and afford to just have the most basic issues dealt with, I think it would alleviate a lot of people's anxieties. And it would actually be kind of create more of a positive feedback in our society because people have less anxiety. They're less likely to get sick. There's less of this sort of scarcity or fear attached to going to a doctor. That, you know, I think looking at it from a really systemic and generalized view of the healthcare system, fitting it within the socioeconomic paradigm that we're in it's all very important. But what really gets people thinking about this and almost radicalizing them, I guess, maybe that's the wrong word for it, but getting them to think a little more deeply about the roots of the problem is when it happens to them personally, when they see people they love, they care for, you know, kind of abused in many ways by the system, when they're at their most vulnerable. And it's sickening, I think. And so speaking for myself, I've only seen a few people close to me go through it, but it's just enough to make me angry. So those are my experiences anyway.
Well, you've also known, I guess, activists in parts of Europe, in places like Canada, that have a very different take on healthcare than a lot of American citizens. I think American citizens I think a lot of this just has to do with how America is historically and geographically placed, but mm-hmm. I think there's this sort of inability to look outward at other countries. And a lot mm-hmm. of times we assume, oh, we're just the best at everything, whether it's mm-hmm. healthcare, economics, everything. We're the best at. But I guess, have you talked to people from other countries that look at the healthcare situation differently, maybe had different experiences when they went to mm-hmm. Europe or Canada or other countries?
Yeah, you know, I've had a few different conversations with, you know, these are people that I know online. I haven't met them personally, but for instance, I've interviewed Reed Wildermuth is one, and Ali Valkyrie. They're both Americans who are kind of, they're pagan anti-capitalists, and they write and they co-founded Gods and Radicals and all of that. And regardless of whatever you think about any of that, the point is just to say that they're leftists and they lived in the United States the majority of their life. And they just made a decision several years ago to move to France and try to become citizens of that country just because they felt almost like a pull or a calling or whatever. But the point is just to say I've read different things from each of them and have had conversations with each of them. And I think one time Reed said something about he went to the doctor for the first time in France. He went to a doctor, and it was just, I don't even know what it was for, some sickness he had. And the doctor's like, okay, well, it's like $25 or something equivalent to 25 euros or whatever it was. It was a very small number. And Reed described this sort of like overwhelming, almost emotion to that, because it was like for the first time in his life, he could feel like, I can afford just basic healthcare. There was something also that that Ali talked about in regards to activism, because in an episode I did with her on my podcast, we talked about this thing called the ZAD, or I guess in French, it basically translate to zone of defense or zone to defend. There's this sort of occupation. It was a 10-year occupation of this land in rural France in order to stop the development of this international airport that the French government and whatever corporations were involved in that were trying to push through. And there were some pretty radical actions taken by activists to get in the way of that project. Anyway, in talking about that subject with her, she was discussing kind of the culture of activism and resistance in France compared to that of the United States. And something she talked about was how it seems contradictory, because, you know, you're in the streets, say in France, fighting the riot police in order to protect this land from being taken over by an airport development project. But also this sense of fighting the state, but also knowing or letting the state know that if you take away certain things from us, including our health care and our access to health care, or the quality of life that we have now, like the government has to respond to that and has to keep the people just happy enough so that they don't have massive general strikes and get in street battles with the police, you know. So when it came to these people occupying the ZAD, which the French police came in, I think it was early this year or last year, whenever it was, and started like engaging in basically a form of warfare, trying to push these people off that land. You know, there were people from all different age groups coming out to support this thing, to stand in solidarity with the people at the ZAD. And Allie went and she saw that, and she described how people there were far less anxious about getting in physical confrontations, doing more physically risky things that could result in injury, just because they had this alleviation of anxiety about access to healthcare. They knew they had this sort of right that they fought for and have continuously fought for, to have access to affordable healthcare, or just free healthcare in general, universal healthcare of some kind. And so that informed their activism. And I was thinking about that. Like, I think about these activists, say that were, I don't know, would be an example. I remember back during Occupy Oakland, there was a veteran with Occupy Oakland, and he got, a shot with a tear gas canister from some police, and it hit him in the head. And then the police kept on shooting. And the point is he had a severe concussion, a brain trauma as a result of this. And I remember just the struggle that activists had of getting funding to help this particular individual get the resources they needed to make a recovery. And so even if you're like engaging in full front, you know, direct activism, you're engaging with police or whatever it is, it's not guaranteed that you're going to have the funds required to take care of yourself if you get hurt or if someone hurts you. I mean, it's an interesting thing. So I think there's a sort of general anxiety in the United States, speaking in a broader sense, not just with activism, but just people in general. They don't want to get into this. They don't want to take unnecessary risks because they are thinking about, what if I get hurt and I have to have an ambulance come picking me up? How much is that? You know, how will I be able to afford all these things? So I think in a general sense, you could look at maybe say other countries that have a sort of universal healthcare system versus the United States. And the general feeling is very different when it comes to these subjects because of people's lack of access or ability to have access to these types of things like healthcare. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I have to make a reference to my favorite genre of music, black metal, because I'm thinking of this song by a band called Samael. And, you know, they have a song called In Gold We Trust. And the first lyrics are, when money rules the game, it diminishes life. It narrows perspective to a single line. And I think that's sort of what we have here. I mean, no one should have to rely on a GoFundMe to raise funds for their, you know, to get medical care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's interesting. I also brought up this band because they do a lot of songs about environmentalism. And I think there's a connection between environmental justice and health justice. I know that you and your podcast, Last Born in the Wilderness, has a strong focus on environmental issues. Do you think these things mm-hmm. are connected?
Yeah, I think there is a connection there somewhere. I think what seem like very different topics, which is, you know, the debate or the political conversation right now about Medicare for all or some sort of single payer healthcare model that, say, Bernie Sanders or some of the more will be defined as within the American political spectrum as being more left or progressive or whatever. Within that spectrum, people are really having a discussion about, the ability of the United States government to push for this type of thing, you know, have legislation put in place to get these sort of rights on the books. So I remember there was this talk. It was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and, you know, by the way, this isn't an endorsement of her or of the Green New Deal or anything, but I thought it was an interesting point that she had made. It was kind of a viral video of her. I don't know. I think it was when the Green New Deal was first proposed and it was basically shot down, and she was pissed and was saying basically, like, this is about a quality of life issue. She was discussing these people in, like, Flint, Michigan, right, as the example, where they have, poisoned, essentially, drinking water that they can't drink still to this day. And there's many other communities around the United States that have the same issue. And how the Green New Deal, in her framing of it, it isn't just like stopping climate change or mitigating it or whatever and restructuring the economy. It's a quality of life issue. You know, environmental issues are also about human health. And if, for instance, there isn't strong, within this framework, if there isn't strong regulations to impede corporations or other industries from polluting water or, for instance, fracking, which is polluting aquifers and causing all kinds of issues or whatever it is, looking at environmentalism and environmental legislation through a lens of, you know, how does this impact human health? Is one, it sort of reminds us, at least very subtly, that we are not separate from the natural world, and that what's happening to the natural world, as it were, is happening also to us. Now, again, this isn't an endorsement of AOC or anything like that. I think, you know, I have a lot of criticisms about her and the Green New Deal, but I think that point and that connection she was making is often missing in the discussion around healthcare, because if we're going to have real substantial healthcare system that takes care of people, we have to also think about, well, what about the quality of air? If cities are becoming so polluted, there's so much smog in the atmosphere surrounding that city, you know, it doesn't matter how good your healthcare system is if people are dying from, are getting sick from all kinds of respiratory diseases and disorders and things like this, then, you know, what's the point? So there has to be this focus that when we talk about even global climate change, you know, as frightening and as almost fatalistic as I can be about that subject, it really is about healthcare too, in a sense, because, I mean, what's the world going to look like 10 to 20 years from now? You know, what's it going to look like? How are we going to live? What's the quality of our life going to be like as a result of climate disruption? And so I think having a substantial debate or really questioning the logic of the healthcare system, because you then question other parts of our system as well. If you see that this is a for-profit healthcare system, which is based on the sort of capitalist logic, people then ask the question, well, my mother or whoever or I had to go through this healthcare system and realize how fucked that is. Maybe there's other aspects of how we treat ourselves and the world that is also based in this logic that maybe we should reassess or change. And so I actually think, this is sort of my grappling with this. There's people that are struggling financially and they cannot get their head above water because of medical bills, because of all of that. And you hope that would radicalize people to see systemic change as a possibility. But most of the time, people are stuck in this anxiety and just swallowed in debt. And it's this sort of interesting thing where you think all of the things that are happening in the world today, whether it's environmental issues, whether it's regarding the healthcare system, whatever it is going to maybe push people towards more radical ideas and solutions. But in a sense, it actually can really drag them down as well and make it almost impossible for change to happen. And so I'm kind of, personally, I'm sort of stuck between that. But if I could try to draw that connection between the environmental crisis and healthcare, I hope I made some sense there with that.
Well, before you go, I think the other connection is that, you know, I think both the climate crisis and the healthcare crisis highlight the utter and complete failure of neoliberalism, this juggernaut that has been rising and devouring everything in our communities since the Reagan-Thatcher years. I mean, you know, you hear sometimes, well, I'll put it this way. There was a Sanders campaign video on Medicare for All, and they were talking about how, you know, in the current system of neoliberalism, all blame is placed on the individual. So if you're having healthcare problems, the response of a neoliberal would be, you know, well, maybe you should exercise more. Maybe you should do yoga, or, you know, all the blame is placed on the individual. And we know that doesn't work. We know that most GoFundMes, I hate to say this, our GoFundMe is doing very well. This family's GoFundMe, I should say, is doing very well. We're at about 10K of the 40K goal. But most people don't meet those goals. And you know, even looking at the way climate change is dealt with under neoliberalism, what are the solutions that private industry can provide for this? I'm not sure they can. They're not up to the task, in my view. I haven't seen evidence for that at this point.
Yeah, you're right. It individualizes the problem. Like, just to tie it into this other environmental issue, there was these, you know, these massive human-caused fires down in Brazil, and people have woken up to the fact that, oh my God, this rainforest, which doesn't had this issue here.
It's interesting because Bolsonaro himself is Mr. Pro-capitalist, Mr. Neoliberal as well. I mean, he has fascist tendencies. It's sort of like a mixture of neoliberalism and sort of authoritarianism combined.
We're seeing, you know, this sort of neoliberal paradigm that we're in is sort of paving the way for these sort of right-wing fascist types, authoritarians, whatever term you want to use to describe it. But, you know, these basically fascists coming into power, and in Brazil, you know, this is a really stark example of this, and seeing dramatically the changes that have come as a result in the Amazon. Now, let's be very clear. This has been going on for decades, the deforestation of not just the Amazon forest, but many forests around the world. You know, it doesn't get nearly as much coverage in the media. It doesn't get talked about, but because of the nature of this, where it just seems like a dramatic rise in, you know, these fires in the Amazon, people are then really waking up to this a little bit. Now, within this sort of neoliberal, project that we've been in the midst of for however many decades, everything does get reduced to individual responsibility.
It's interesting because it just popped in my head. It's like when people tell me, you know, when it comes to environmental issues, there's always the push for you have to do little things on an individual level. Take less showers. Reuse your towels after your showers. Use less water. And I'm always thinking to myself when I hear that, the municipal golf course in a suburb uses more water in a day than anything you can do on an individual level to reduce your water use.
Right.
It blows my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I know exactly. It's like it individualizes activism. It individualizes your action that you can take. So, for instance, just mentioning these fires, what I've been hearing over and over again is really oversimplistic, you know, reasons why this is happening. One of them is like they blame it on Bolsonaro, of course, which, yeah, of course, he's a part of this, but he's a symptom. It's just like Donald Trump. You know, it's not like, you know, when they leave power, if they leave power, that force that they've kind of tapped into, is it going to go away? You know, there's something there that's going to linger for much longer than they could ever live, you know, or be in that position of power. So we need to first do that. But also the other thing is like people have been saying, you know, it's the beef industry, and it is. It's honestly, there's ranchers and various, you know, agriculturalist farmers that are burning down these forests so they can make way for more development of the land for crop production, for beef and, you know, production of beef and all this stuff. So people are like, don't eat meat, don't eat beef. But I'm like, okay, I get where you're coming from, but, this is only one facet of a larger problem. We also do a lot of other things that exploit that forest as well that don't get addressed. And so it kind of becomes this very politicized, individualized choice where you, the individual, stop eating meat, stop doing this, stop doing this, stop doing this. And that's somehow going to stop this from happening. And that's just a delusion. Like you mentioned, that municipal golf course, yeah, they use far more resources than any of us individually could ever use. You know, there are institutions and corporations and other powers that exist that are really the most responsible for the climate crisis, for the environmental crisis and the like. Now, absolutely, we should maybe withdraw our financial monetary support in a way, you know, like, yeah, you know, people boycotting the beef industry, for instance, go for it. But that's not going to come from individual actions. That's going to come from individuals deciding to work together collectively to stop this from happening. And then they need to go further than that. So then you also take that with the healthcare system and how, like you mentioned with these GoFundMes, they don't often meet the goals that they have or need because, again, it's individualized. Some people are lucky. Some people have enough network, a big enough network of people that they can draw on for support and resources to pay for their medical needs. But many people don't have that. And so it's just not equal. It's so, you know, certain. It's just such a mess. And so, yeah, you know, it just sort of the neoliberalism puts the impetus on the individual to figure it out. And it's just not enough. And it's not honest. You know, it's not honest to what human beings actually, I think, want and what we crave, which is a real sense of community and coming together for a common purpose, which can go in bad directions, but also can go in very positive and good directions as well. So when it comes to healthcare, I think we need to kind of understand that the quality of life mentally, you know, physically, even spiritually, I would say that quality goes up when people feel a sense of security, like I have something to draw upon regarding healthcare. So, I think that neoliberalism in particular has, really fucked with how we view this whole thing. And we forget how new it really is, too. Like, this is a newer, more recent phenomenon. So we can draw upon other ways of thinking and being that can maybe help us see this a little more clearly, I think.
I guess in closing, you know, here in Pennsylvania, a lot of people have healthcare issues. There's a really bad opioid crisis. I know a lot of people in Pennsylvania supported the candidacy of Donald Trump. So there's a lot of heat on Pennsylvania, especially even parts of Pittsburgh at times. But I think if leftists are willing to come together and help people with healthcare issues, help stemming the tide of the opioid epidemic in whatever way that we can do that, I think we can change hearts and minds. What is your sort of take on what we can do community-wise to sort of stem these tides and sort of build a social base?
Yeah, man, I don't know.
I think that's a fair response.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I get these occasionally. I get, you know, an email or two or, you know, some messages from people that listen to my podcast and ask me, like, I don't know what direction to go in. I don't know what to do. How do we build these things that you're talking about? And I have to remind them and myself that I'm wondering aloud myself about these subjects. How do we build community and networks and stuff? I mean, you know, just something that came up in my mind just now is, and I don't know how to draw that connection, but there's a group that I interviewed a person who was a part of it called Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. It's kind of this kind of grassroots network of people who go to communities that are experiencing typically climate disaster related things. So hurricanes, flooding, fires, things like this. There's other networks similar to this, which is kind of based in sort of an anarchist principle of direct action and mutual aid and all this stuff. And so when they go into a community, you know, they see what the community is you know, needing, they ask people directly, what do you need? And they're like, we need water, we need food, we need electricity, we need all these things. And then they do everything they can to just provide that directly to them. They don't go through this, you know, FEMA or the Red Cross. They don't go through these bureaucratic organizations, NGOs or whatever they may be, to provide the aid required. So there are models that exist. Now, that's, of course, specific to disaster relief. But I'm also thinking of other, I don't even know, I can't think of anything at the moment, but there are other examples that we can look to where I think healthcare can be provided on that grassroots level. And I think by providing, I can't think of any particular group or organization at this moment, but I'm sure they exist, possibly. I would have to do some research into that. But, you know, the idea that you could provide something like, one, a community that comes from the grassroots that just directly aids people in what they need at that time. You know, looking to organizations that are doing that is really key here, because if they're not, if they're trying to, and I think by doing that, actually, like with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, what I kind of pulled out of that interview with Desiree Lynn, who I spoke with in that episode, was about how by coming into these communities and this post-disaster, right, they just had this really almost apocalyptic event occur to them. These groups come in and they start to, you know, show people, like, this is what's possible. This is another world that we could live in. Now, this is specifically for disaster relief, but you could imagine this model being applied in numerous ways, including how we provide healthcare for people. And I think that opens up the possibilities. It allows people to imagine what's possible in this time. So again, without giving you a real good answer, I think I would look, that's what I would look for. That's the kind of criteria that I would be looking out for if I were looking for models of how to address this more systemically.
Well, yeah, and like I said, I think we can really change hearts and minds if we go out there and do things, say help with a fundraiser or you know, get involved in our community. I mean, we can argue about politics online on Twitter and Facebook, but what's really going to change people is you know, working on a community level with others. And, you know, when other people see that, you know, I think it can really change someone's mind. Even, you know, if I'm at the grocery and someone is short on change, you know, I may give them money. That can really change a person's outlook if it keeps happening enough to them. So I think if we lend a helping hand towards each other, a lot of the issues we see can maybe not change overnight, but I think kindness can do some things.
Yes, I think so as well. Yeah, that sense of solidarity, of being held in a community sense, is a profound human experience. It's one of the most beautiful things that people can experience. And that's actually this interesting phenomenon that sociologists and psychologists and other disciplines have studied. People that are in disaster scenarios will look back at that time like, yeah, that was a hard time, but like, actually, I was never more, interestingly, more happy, because I think it really drew on those pro-social elements of human nature. It's like, You felt needed, and you were, and you had needs that were being met by others directly. And that kind of pulls you out of this alienating, kind of suffocating culture that we have. And it reveals to us something. And I don't think necessarily people have the language to even describe it, but they just describe it as like, that was actually a positive experience. Now, not to just gloss over the horrors that come with disasters, I'm just sort of trying to say that, you know, it surprises people what they get out of those experiences. And so, interestingly, when people are in, you know, a situation where they need to pay for healthcare, two things come up, which is despair, because they can't fund it, they can't pay for it. But then maybe, and this is a big maybe, they get the funding and the resources they need because communities come together to help them. And so we have to make that second part more of a reality for people, in however we can, in whatever way that we can. And by doing that, we can demonstrate what's possible for people.
Well, hey, Patrick, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I don't know if you want to tell my listeners how they can get in contact with you or listen to your podcast, but go right ahead, man. I really appreciate your coming on for this fundraiser edition of the show.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate the fact that you thought of me and thought I could come on and maybe provide something for this. So it's great to be a part of this as well. So thank you for inviting me on. And I would just say if people want to learn more, I mean, my podcast is Last Born in the Wilderness. You can go to the website, lastborninthewilderness.com. That's a really good base. Everything is there. But, you know, I am on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. That's all there. Plus, you know, the podcast is on pretty much every major podcast streaming app from SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, and all that. And again, the website's the best place to go for all that information. So, and yeah, if people have questions or anything, and there's a contact form on that website as well for that, is to contact me if people have questions about that.
And finally, wrapping up part one of our fundraiser edition of Parallax Views, artist Terry Tapp joins us, and boy, is he angry about the issue of health injustice. And I can understand why. The struggle people face to acquire the care they need is enough to make all our blood boil. But in spite of the rage it all inspires, Terry believes another future is possible. Let's listen. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Terry Tapp, artist and host of the Other Future podcast, just started up. People should check it out. How are you doing tonight, Terry?
I'm doing fine, man. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Just frantically trying to put together this fundraiser podcast. I already have a few segments, and I wanted to get you on. We're basically trying to raise awareness about for a GoFundMe for a family in Pittsburgh whose father is having a lot of really difficult healthcare troubles. His Medicare days have run out, so we're trying to get funds together to help him out. I mean, he's a great member of the community, a ninth grade algebra teacher, helped his students a lot. And it's just a shame that we have to have a GoFundMe fundraiser just to get this man help. What are your thoughts maybe on the healthcare sort of situation in America, though?
Well, I mean, aside from the fact that it's a crime that someone would have to have a GoFundMe for their health needs, and that if you simply lived in Mexico or Canada or France or Germany or a long, long list of countries, this would be a moot point. Aside from that, I mean, it's consistent with the death cult that runs this country. You know, the cult that is putting together a planet-destroying fossil fuel plan, healthcare that's actually death care, a lot of industries that are basically there to destroy your simple ability to function and to live. That's consistent. But looking at it from a broader perspective of the sanity of most of the rest of the planet Earth, it's a travesty.
Well, you know, I was going to add to that. It's interesting you bring up the sort of death cult aspect, because you have all these people on the conservative side of things that will say, you know, oh, death panels, you know, socialized healthcare, death panels. And yet these are the same people that would say, well, if I have the money, I should be able to get my healthcare. And the person who doesn't have that money, screw them. You know, they're the ones that believe in the death panels in a way.
Yeah, they are the death panel. I mean, if you look at most of the people pushing that, either have good health care from their jobs, or they're aligned with, or they are receiving health care from the government in the way of being a senator or from Medicare. I mean, they're not struggling. No one who is in need of medical care actually says, fuck it, and, you know, let's be on our own.
Well, what are your maybe personal anecdotes about dealing with the healthcare system? I know a lot of people have had issues with the healthcare system, or known people who have had issues with it.
But is there anybody you know who has no anecdote? That's the interesting thing to me. Like, there's no person I know who'd have, except for someone who perhaps is very wealthy, who doesn't have an anecdote about the healthcare system, a time when they didn't have healthcare, a time when their friend didn't. You know, I'll give you one. It's the only one because they're so numerous, not only in my life, but like I said, in everyone's life I know. You know, many years ago, I think it was in the late 90s, I had been in contact with a guy in Houston who advertised in Fact Sheet 5. You know Fact Sheet 5, right? Or knew of it?
Yes, yes. I'm a little bit familiar. Refresh my memory, though.
Fact Sheet 5, back pre-internet days, in the 80s, actually, before my time in this, there was a publication called Fact Sheet 5. And in Fact Sheet 5, you would mail them a zine, and they would review your zine. And they had a habit, out of San Francisco, they had a habit of not tearing into people for their lack of aesthetics, lack of design, lack of readability, lack of editing, and things like that, which was a little bit of a shame. But they were great in the fact that your zine would be reviewed by them. In the back of Fact Sheet 5, they would have a lot of networking advertisements. So a gentleman had put an ad in there in the mid-90s about wanting to put a comic together. And he wanted something that was very aesthetically, narratively challenging. It sounded interesting. So I sent him some samples of my comic work, and he responded very favorably, and we began an actual snail mail correspondence. And then he disappeared for about 6 months. And when I got back in touch with him, actually when he wrote me again, he explained that he had fallen into a diabetic coma. He had type 1 diabetes. And he had been in this coma living in Houston. He'd been robbed. He basically almost died. And I was taken to a hospital by someone who found his body. I invited him. I had left where I was living at the time, moved back to Kentucky. I was living in a farmhouse on like 90 acres of land. I invited him to come and live with me, rent free, get back on his feet, get his health back together. And he did. And we became good friends. Recently, I believe it was last year or the year before, there was a protest in Boston of the company that provides insulin. And his name was on a mock tombstone. What had happened is he had moved back to Houston and had become a big name in the comic scene there, organizing a lot of comic conventions, zine conventions. He was always into small press things. None of this was, you know, big commercial Marvel, DC, things like that. But he had been helping his mother, who had moved from Beaumont to Mena, Arkansas, and apparently was trying to get his healthcare switched, you know, from Arkansas to Texas and back. And in between those switches and in between needing insulin, went into a coma and passed away. And he, at the time, was 49, 50, and is now gone. But that's one of many. I mean, I'm sure you can come up with them. Here, you got one right now with your fundraiser. And that's the travesty, the fact that I can't tell you anything new about that.
Well, I was going to add, you know, there's an article that just got published in Vice. And the headline is, Joe Biden. And this is what Joe Biden says. It would be an insult to my dead son for everyone to have health care. And you know what? It's just my head wants to explode when I read a headline like that. That's utterly just, it's repulsive.
I have to say, I want his head to explode when I read a headline like that. I saw that today, late today, and I was just stunned. The fact you could be that out of touch. I mean, why would you deny people a basic need, a basic right? Just there's no logic to that. The only logic I could see is that the illogic of his position is a continuation of the corporate democratic position. So in that sense, it is logical in the sense of being consistent. But at its core, it's illogical. I mean, you can parse that out, and what does that mean? You know, I have two children. At different times, they had no health care. And I've been out, you know, $7,000-$8,000 at a time, paying for accidental injury, paying for dental care. You know, that's monstrous. So the fact your son had health care means other people shouldn't?
Well, then there's the other excuse that people like Beto O'Rourke will use where they say, You know, we don't have time to get the perfect solution. You know, we can't start from scratch. You know, maybe single payer would be good if we could start from scratch, but we've got to work with the system that we have today. And I'm like,
yeah,
that's such bullshit.
All these people are disgusting. You know, I like Sanders in the sense that he's the only reasonable centrist that I can come across at this time. But I hate hearing these discussions because, you know, when you hear some fraud like Beto O'Rourke or Joe Biden, a monster like Joe Biden, who actually may have accomplished the feat of being more toxic than Hillary Clinton, when I hear this bullshit come out of their mouths, it stuns me to the effect that, you know, if you had a child who was being harmed, beaten, molested, whatever, and you had some solution where you're only going to beat or molest this child about half of what you're doing now, and you're going to have the child beg for that. That's analogous to our situation right now. It's a basic right in almost every other country on the planet. So the fact that the supposed wealthiest country doesn't have this isn't something we should be debating. It's something that we should have our representatives running in fear from, dodging bullets, barricading themselves in. The fact that we all have anecdotes about people who've died from these simple, fixable problems, that you could have someone like a Biden or an O'Rourke who can say, you know, we can't come up with the best solution. What's the fucking best solution mean? We know Medicare works, so just extend it. There's a solution, and you're done. And we can move on to more interesting things. It's just monstrous. You know, I shouldn't even give more examples of this, but I was talking with my girlfriend about this. I was in a place on the Lower East Side a few years ago, a wine bar, and I was listening to a conversation. You know, these are small venues, so these people are crammed in by me. And a woman was talking about her husband, and they had, you know, they had been living together. He had felt ill. He had no insurance. She had great insurance. They were talking about getting married. They waited a year. And when they did get married and he then had insurance, you know, from her policy, he went to the doctor and he had a massive tumor in his torso. And I don't know what specifics about it. This was a conversation I essentially overheard, but I participated in a little. And they told them, you know, if you could get there a year earlier, if you could have gotten there, to give that the right tense, you could have been saved. So, you know, if she went to one of your major healthcare providers and just gunned down the board of directors, would you blame her? I wouldn't. So why are we begging for these crumbs from a fraud like Beto O'Rourke, who's basically just a Republican? Or Joe Biden or anyone. This is a basic thing. Other taxes in other countries cover this. Why don't ours? And the fact I'm even having to say that, everyone's saying that. Sarah Silverman's saying that. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is saying that. Rashida Tlaib. You can go down a list of decent politicians, and there are very few, but there are some. And they are saying this is a basic right. Like I said, you go to Mexico. If you go to Mexico City, you'll have coverage. You have to wait because it's a tremendously populated city.
Well, that's what they say about Canada. They say that about the NHS in Britain. Oh, you have to wait in line then. And I'm like, well, you know, so basically we should have a system. Like I said earlier, these people want us to have a system where you either can afford it and you can't. And if you can't afford it, die. I don't understand that. It's beyond me. And I'm sorry for interrupting, but this situation has increasingly just aggravated me.
So the argument is that if you can't afford it, the market can decide it. So if it's there, you can have it. If it's not there, you can't. And the presence or lack of presence of money will decide it. So I guess if I can afford bullets and a gun, then I can put a bullet in your head. And if I can't afford it, I can't do that. So the market decided that for me. I mean, you can break it down. It's about seven steps, actually about three steps to get to that. You know, it's a ridiculous and sick position, no pun intended. I really think, you know, the more I read about, you know, what Russian cosmism is.
No, tell me a little bit about that.
There was a movement in Russia, not the Soviet Union, be very specific about that. In Russia, coming out of the nihilists and the anarchists and heretics within the Greek Orthodox Church, actually, called Russian Cosmism. And their position was essentially that we had the technology, the know-how, and the mystical ability to push this program of resurrecting the dead, of living as art, of traveling to new planets. It was just beautifully wild. And I heard, his name is Boris Groys, G-R-O-Y-S. He teaches NYU. He's a Russian scholar. He was talking about Russian cosmism. And he said, you know, the main distinction between Russian cosmism and Marxism is that, excuse me, I'm drinking a bunch of coffee here, is that the Russian cosmists didn't accept death as a given, as part of nature. And they thought part of your political program should be the elimination of death, retrospectively as well as proactively, prescriptively. So I think we could have a program and should have a program taking off of the 1970s that actually pushes us further, that lets our enemies, this death cult that's centered in Washington and Wall Street, push us back. You know, there was a book in I think it came out in 74 by Alan Harrington called The Immortalist. And The Immortalist, what he was talking about in there was the technology we had in 74 that would allow for eternal life. And by eternal life, he really meant about a 300-year life extension of your life to about 300 years. So it's a relative eternal life and indefinitely long life. But 300 years, and 300 years in health, not 300 years as a, you know, octogenarian who's suffering from a lot of disease. We had that then. Now we have even greater technologies. And there are many people who make a good case that a lot of our scientific research is purposely held down by the market itself, that people are kept from releasing a lot of findings and pushing forth treatments for cancer, treatments for a lot of diseases, because it would interfere with big pharma, with a lot of the medical industry and their profits. So what I would say is we should actually have a policy or a set of policies that pushes for something akin, at least metaphorically, to Russian cosmism. We should be pushing for not our ability to take care of our teeth at the dentist or to treat a single tumor or to provide insulin, but something radical, something absolutely lunatic.
We should be dreaming big.
Yeah, we should be dreaming insanely, because the wealthy are dreaming that way. If you look up transhumanist sites, if you look up a lot of the sites that cover what is possible out there, the wealthy are talking about indefinite life extension, much like Alan Harrington. If you start following this path online, I'm not talking about some sort of Alex Jones ridiculousness. I'm talking about actual technologies that are out there. You can look at what could be available to the common person. I mean, the rich are just common people with digits attached to them. So these are common people who are dreaming these lunatic dreams of an indefinite life extension and an indefinite life extension of their death cult, which is vampiric. So you could have a policy which doesn't beg creeps like Beto O'Rourke to take seriously the fact that you don't want your spouse or your partner to die of a simple treatable ailment. And most of those ailments are not only treatable, but they're things that, you know, you have a rotting tooth and it causes the teeth to rot and it puts toxins into your bloodstream and some of those stick into your arteries and eventually you have a heart disease. These aren't things you can just run out and get a treatment for. You need updated treatments. You need ongoing treatments. So, you know, instead of begging creeps like that to help you, or especially begging the Republican Ghoul Party to help you, you should be pushing a very aggressive policy that demands the latest in technology and demands a realization of the dreams of those who are pushing those technologies. Why not? What's holding us back from that?
Well, you know, I wanted to say in regards to policy talk, because that ends up getting into the territory of you know, what C. Derek Varn, a recent guest on your show, has called, and a friend of mine, has called, you know, Wonktopia. You know, the wonks are loose. But, yeah. You know, it's... I look at the policy stuff, you know, and I was talking to Ben Burgess earlier. I interviewed him in a short segment for this fundraiser. And, you know, even Ben, who is, you know, Mr. Logic for the Left, about making logical arguments against the clowns like Ben Shapiro and their toxicity. And, you know, even Ben couldn't help but say, you know, at a point this goes way beyond talking about policy. You know, this issue of getting health justice now, as the activist Tim Faust is calling for, it's a question of what world do we want to live in, and, you know, why do we have to accept the moral depravity of, you know, not getting people that need the care care? And I don't care about the arguments that Ezra Klein and Matthew Iglesias and other wonks want to make against a better healthcare system, that think that ACA is just enough. It's not enough. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, and on a policy note, the ACA, I called a navigator in New York City eventually about that, because trying to figure those out was insane. And I don't think I'm stupid, so I would assume that your average person is struggling with trying to figure that out. And the ACA, it was a plan originally from the Heritage Institute, I mean, Heritage Foundation, in the 90s. It was a Republican plan to avoid a single payer system. So the fact that we're even debating it now or trying to tear it up is ridiculous. I wouldn't have implemented it in the first place. But the thing that I do agree with like Sanders and Warren both, is that if you could take what is there now, the ACA, and just extend it, you would actually have a decent plan, which is where we were headed to, or trying to head to originally. Actually, it was Hillary Clinton who was pushing that. But the fact we're discussing that, I really don't get the fact that it's like discussing keeping children in cages. Could we only keep them there half the time? Could we keep them in better cages? Could we only molest them half the time? Could we give them a toothbrush on Wednesdays? I mean, these are the debates of maniacs. You know, you know who Lewis Mumford was?
Yes. Yeah. Our architecture writing, correct?
That was a tiny thing he did. I would really recommend anyone listening, if you don't know about him, to dive into his work. He wrote books like The Myth of the Mega Machine, Art and Technics and Society. His main focus was looking at technology and what it did to us. And it was absolutely brilliant, and one of the true genius non-academic intellectuals. But Lewis Mumford was in one of his books. I actually think it was Technics and Society. He said, you know, I think he died in the early 60s, late 50s. He was active in the 20s and the teens and the turn of the 19th to 20th century. He said in World War I, there was a debate about the humaneness of mustard gas. And you probably know what mustard gas does to a person. It's horrific. But there was this debate about whether or not it was actually moral to use mustard gas rather than to gun someone down or you know, impale them on a bayonet. And he said the very fact that you could have that debate, that you could ask yourself, is it better to stick a bayonet into your chest or spray you with mustard gas, shows that you're absolutely morally bankrupt. So the fact you could say, you know, I think that in terms of libertarian economics or in death cult economics or in simple obeisance to oligarchy, it's better if you struggle for this insurance or maybe suffer a little or suffer minimally or moderately. I mean, this is the rock bottom of human ethics.
Well, I was going to ask, in relation to your book, out by Zero Books, A Serf's Journal, the story of the United States' longest wildcat strike, you've talked about the struggles of laborers. I think these things are all connected. I was telling another guest who deals with environmental issues, who came on for a short segment in this fundraiser, Patrick Farnsworth of the Last Born in the Wilderness podcast. I was telling him, I think environmental justice is connected to health justice. I think the struggles of laborers are connected to both those things. I think all these things are connected, and I agree with Martin Luther King. That was what Martin Luther King was saying before his assassination, that the economic injustice, the war of Vietnam, that racism, all of these things are connected in a greater struggle.
You know, they have to be connected. I mean, that's what King was doing when he was – that was the sanitation workers. It began as a wildcat and then was supported by the union that he went to speak at, that he was, in which he was assassinated, at which he was assassinated. But, yeah, of course. You know, I had good health insurance as a kid, and I did because of my father's union. He got a job at an aluminum plant as a laborer. And I actually, you know, for a while, just knocking slag off these big pots with a sledgehammer. But he was originally with the aluminum workers, then with the steel workers union. And they fought for good insurance. And for a while had it. It's been, you know, beaten down. But it was good insurance. Even when I worked at that shipyard, about which that book was written, when I worked there, I was with the Teamsters. And an IWW member, but the IWW, of course, it was much smaller than it is now and couldn't help with insurance. But the Teamsters, they were lousy. And even their lousy insurance at 80-20 plan was better than nothing. So, I mean, labor struggles are tied in with this. Environmental struggles are tied in with this, you know, with like cancer alleys and things like that. This is all tied together. But the fact that we can, you know, again, with unions, the fact you can have some garbage, this happened 2 years ago, talking to the plant in Indiana, I think it was outside of Indianapolis, and just the guy was reading off. He said, you know, we're really working with people, but we're going to be closing down. The plant's moving to Mexico, and people are yelling at him. They needed to put a rope around his neck and hang him. He doesn't need, like, the very fact you can tell someone, I'm destroying your livelihood, and you were supposed to do what? Take it? That should be a real struggle. The fact you can tell someone, I'm juggling your health right now, that's a real struggle. And the fact that we're having to have a debate about it shows just how crushed we've gotten. Our so-called leaders should fear us. And by fearing us, I'm not necessarily saying guns and ropes. I am definitely saying that we should be pushing agendas that are far, far beyond what is, you know, what are the crumbs that we're seeking right now from these monsters like an O'Rourke or a Biden or especially a Trump and a McConnell and those other devils.
Well, I was going to add to that. You know, I'm just utterly – it blows my mind how far we've come just from the early days of the Reagan-Thatcher era to now. I mean, people have been propagandized to the point where they think the private sector can just do everything. It's perfect. The private sector is apparently the only way to innovate. It doesn't matter that we wouldn't have the internet if it wasn't for government research and development. You know, it doesn't matter that there was a huge public infrastructure going back to FDR's New Deal and LBJ's Great Society. I'm not saying that those presidents were, you know, even that far left. I mean, in a lot of ways, they would have been considered more to the center back then. But at least there was something there. At least there was an idea of a public good. At least there was an idea of, you know, a role for government other than working for the corporations.
Yeah. There was an idea. I mean, and there was an idea of a society. And there was an idea of an obligation to each other. And we do have that obligation. And I mean, I still see the obligation, but these people don't believe in society and they don't believe in a public and they don't believe in any obligation to anyone. If they can rob you and you don't get your hands around their throat and don't, and especially now that that idea won't even occur to you. And I'm not trying to be violent or speak about violence, but if I'm robbing someone or telling someone that their child's going to die and that's preventable and I could help you, but I'm not, you should be enraged psychotically even. But the fact that we're not, the fact that doesn't even occur to people now is telling about what's happened psychopolitically to this country. that change psychopolitically has happened since Reagan.
Well, yeah, I mean, it goes back to what Margaret Thatcher said. There is no society. There are only individuals. I mean, it's horrific. I feel like I'm living in a J.G. Ballard novel rather than a utopian future.
Yeah. My only hope about all this is that if we can somehow deal with climate change to some manageable level, this is so bad. And when you talk about something like healthcare, the hideousness of the system is so obvious that it almost, in a Taoist sense, calls for its own eradication by the opposite. Like there's almost a demand in the human collective unconscious, not to pull all this, that kind of stuff out, but still, there's almost a demand for a mass sainthood to erupt, you know, a mass feeling of obligation and care for one another. This is so much to the other side. And the fact that you can, you know, I still don't get it. The fact we have these debates about preventable problems. I was reading, I can't pinpoint where this was, but some time ago, a long time ago, actually, I was reading a discussion by a man from somewhere in Africa, and it's somewhere that was very traditional. He said, I don't understand the problem of homelessness. He said, you don't have homelessness in the villages I come from. He said, if someone was outside, it's getting dark, and they have no place to be, someone would invite them in. And that should be understood as a basic thing, a basic act of human decency. The fact we not only have homeless, but the fact you can have someone who's suffering next door to you, and you actually know a doctor, there's a hospital down the road, they could treat them. I mean, we spend so much on defense. Any of that, a penny of that, a tiny portion of that would take care of most of those people. So the fact we're not is a point of moral depravity that's almost incomprehensible.
Well, I guess in closing, do you think there is hope for, to borrow a phrase from the title of your podcast, the other future, the future that we were promised before this, you know, neoliberal hegemon sort of just ransacked us? You know, it's like the biggest bank robbery ever, and it happened right under our noses.
Well, I think this, and this is neither hopeful nor despairing, but I was talking with a gentleman the other day. He's almost 80, and I've known him for many, many years, at least 40 years now. Well, not quite that, but I've known him for many years. And he was talking about climate change. And he said, you know, these companies that knew about this, he said, I suspected this many years ago, and I knew that they were doing this meaning the neoliberal takeover you're alluding to there. And he said, you know, this could have been dealt with. He said, if we didn't have these people moving society in the way they did, we could have been on other planets by now. We could have had the, you know, indefinite life extension, a la Alan Harrington, 300 years. We could have gotten rid of cancer. We could have done so many things if that money hadn't been sucked up to these third-rate thinkers, morally depraved monsters.
Well, I mean, metaphorically, they're like these vampires. You know, it's
yeah,
like
exactly.
A giant vampiric bat monster that's just sucking the population dry. It's something out of my worst nightmares.
Yeah, it's sucking the life out of the planet itself at this point. But the interesting thing is, he could talk extensively about the other future, the future that when he was a kid and then when he was in his, 30s, in the 70s, was actually something intellectuals discussed and something that, you know, at least your average informed person could talk about. As a person much younger than this guy, I know bits of it, and I know a lot of it really from like underground comic books in the 70s I picked up and reading about what people were saying was coming, what we could do, and comparing that to the contemporary reality they were living in. So I know pieces of it. He has a full picture of where we could have gone. So what I'm trying to do, and it's very loose with the podcast, but it's with my writing, the writing I'm working on now, is trying to assemble two things. One is that future we're headed toward of massive, amazing utopian possibility, and before it, how to get away from the cliff, you know, monstrous vampiric future that we're being pushed toward. I mean, the conclusion of this future, and it's a conclusion that's coming very soon, is a dead planet. You know, not just a dead friend, a dead spouse, not just your death prematurely and unnecessarily because you don't have the adequate coverage, but a dead planet. If we can move back from that and assemble a puzzle piece, a puzzle that actually shows us how to get away from that, which does exist. We're almost out of time, but it does exist. Then we can also put together something I know a little of, and someone, you know, many years older than me knows a lot about, which was this other thing we were supposed to have. We're supposed to have a utopia by now, and we were supposed to be far more human than we are now. And I don't mean in some, you know, Harari sense of giant bank accounts and, you know, big muscles and x-ray vision, but with extended abilities for compassion and creativity and longevity and health and things like this. We could have had that, and there was a picture of it. So I'm trying to assemble that picture along with this other picture. And if that can be done and get gotten out to enough people and people acting on it, then we could still have that.
Well, I want to thank you again, Terry Tapp, for coming on Parallax Views, especially for this fundraiser. I've been getting more and more riled up about the health justice issue as I keep doing these short segments for the fundraiser. Hope I wasn't like too too wired for this conversation, but I want to thank you again.
I'm trying to hold back because it's an enraging, you know, when we talk about these things, not just you and me, but talking with other people, I'm not trying to advocate violence. And I realize I'm passionate about them, not just this, but many things. But the point is that, you know, if someone were murdering you right now, which they are, with if you don't have adequate insurance, and other people around you are not freaking out and angry and murderously angry in turn, it's a form of psychopathy. And I don't quite understand it. Again, you know, with jobs, with the environment. You know, the fact that so many black communities, like Flint, Michigan or Newark, New Jersey, you know, that their water quality is toxic. The fact they aren't in mass, like hanging CEOs and politicians from lampposts is to me stunning. And I'm not saying they should do it. But what I'm saying is the fact they aren't doing it is so anti-human in the sense of anti-survival. I'm stunned. And the fact we're having to talk, about somebody who's contributed this much to a community who needs help, begging for help is psychotic.
Well, I don't want to get in trouble by promoting violence here, but
no, I'm not promoting it. I'm just saying morally we should. I'm not saying actually we should. So let me skip that. Law enforcement, NSA, no one should be hurt, especially people who are killing other people. They shouldn't be hurt. Yes. But so I'm not advocating it. But morally, it would make sense that as a survival instinct, you would do that. That's my point.
Well, I was going to say it reminds me of the great Utah Phillips quote, the earth is not dying. It is being killed. And those who are killing it have names and addresses, which he was very much right about that.
Yes, exactly. And the 9-year-olds and the 12-year-olds who realize that given our current trajectory, they will have no future, I think are really taking that to heart. So yeah, I'm not advocating violence, but at the same time, if someone's being harmed and they're not fighting back to the degree they're being harmed with a legitimate response, it really pains me. It makes me wonder, like, what's torn that survival instinct out of them? If I were harming someone, bulldozing their home, and they wrote me a letter about it, they went and talked to their friends. They got a petition together. I'm mowing over their child's bedroom. Their child is screaming. I'm in my bulldozer. And, you know, they put up a sign about it. They post on Facebook. I would think they're out of their mind. And everything that's going on now is far beyond merely bulldozing, you know, your child into a grave. It's bulldozing a planet. So the fact that we're holding back and saying, well, you know, I don't want to say anything outrageous. It tells me that something's been cut out of us, and it's a basic instinct. So I'm not advocating violence on that. I am looking at a situation and saying, given self-preservation, I would expect a response that is appropriate to the action that is being perpetrated against someone. And the fact it's not there, and in a normative sense, they should do it, but the fact they're not stuns me.
Well, the fact they're just not angry, you know, there's not enough rage.
You know, in Kentucky, it's so odd to see Team Mitch signs in very poor areas. A lot of the state is very poor. It's one of the poorest states. But to see Team Mitch signs, you know, in desperately poor areas, I still don't understand that. I mean, what could you possibly get out of that? You're supporting someone that's destroying your family and destroying their future and destroying their present. And this is the only life you've got. So where does that come from?
Well, I wanted to ask if you have any parting words for this fundraiser edition of the show. Put it out there right now. And again, thank you for coming on the podcast again, Terry. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. I've enjoyed it. I really hope that this succeeds, man. It seems like an excellent cause. So good luck to you and good luck to him.
Well, that does it for this Parallax Views fundraiser special. Been burning the midnight oil trying to get it out there, folks. If you can, please donate to the cause. You can find a link to the GoFundMe page in the episode synopsis. Any donation, big or small, is greatly appreciated. Let's work for health justice now. J.G. Michael, Parallax Views, signing out.